Lecture 38, Going to Trial in Ancient Athens.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. In previous lectures, we covered aspects of the judicial system, such as its machinery and its process, which have set us up for this, our final lecture on our theme of law, and that is what the actual trial day entailed. What happened when a case went to trial? What was required on the part of the litigants? What sort of arguments were used to sway the jury? How did the jury vote? How long did a trial last? And what are some of the striking differences between classical trials and those of today? These are the questions we're going to take up now, and we'll build this lecture around them. A number of trials would be heard on the days when the courts met, which was about two-thirds or so of the year. The jurors would not know in advance which trial they were hearing until they were assigned to an actual court. The jurors-to-be arrived at the court complexes very early in the morning, around daybreak. They underwent a multi-stage selection process. Included in this process was tokens or markers that had the name of a different juror on each of them. They were put into an allotment machine called the clarotarion, and the tokens were arbitrarily selected so that no one knew which juror's name would come out and which would not. This is a bit like the numbers on balls today in lottery draws. The process must have taken some time, and those men who were not selected for duty that day simply went home and tried again another day. Once assigned to their courts, the jurors sat through some administrative proceedings, such as selecting one person to be in charge of the water clock, which measured the length of speeches. They also selected four persons who were responsible for the ballot urns into which the jurors cast their votes. And they probably also finalized details to do with their payment at the end of the trial day. And when all these sorts of things were over and done with, the trial proper began. The trial was divided into three stages, and the term usually applied to the whole trial process is the tripartite day, or the measured out day, a term that refers to the water that timed court speeches and was measured out, literally, by the water clock. The first third of the day was given over to the prosecution's case, the second third to the defense's case, and then if the defendant was found guilty, in many cases he could propose an alternative penalty. The final third of the day was given over to speeches about that penalty. The speakers had the same amount of time, and this was strictly controlled by a water clock. It consisted of a number of urns holding a certain amount of water, and each urn had a hole in the bottom closed off by a bung. One full urn was placed on a short pedestal above an empty one. The bung was removed, and when the water flowed into the empty one, the full one was replaced. This procedure was repeated to coincide with, literally, the measured out day. Now, a water clock was discovered in the Agora of Athens. And when we see how long it took to empty and compare this to the number of urns that we hear about in some forensic speeches, a best guessed estimate is that in a public trial, and there was only one public trial per day, remember, the trial day lasted for 6 hours, 36 minutes. And therefore, each third of the day lasted for 2 hours and 12 minutes. Now, the water clock was not stopped for the quoting of supporting evidence, such as laws, oracles, and decrees in public trials. The water clock was only stopped in private suits when evidence was quoted. This meant that in a public suit, you had to time your speech very closely, especially if you wanted to include all sorts of supporting evidence. And we have a number of forensic speeches with references in them to lines like, "Gentlemen of the jury, I could tell you more, but I see the water is against me. Or at the end of a speech, there is a reference to handing over the water to another prosecutor. These references refer to the water clock and the amount of time available, or not available. The jurors voted at the end of the defense speech, so the second third of the day. Each juror was given one bronze disc with a solid axle through the center, and one bronze disc with a hollow axle through the center. The solid axle was to acquit the defendant, and the hollow axle was to convict him. The jurors cast one of these ballots, the one that they wanted to be counted, into a bronze urn. And they discarded the other ballot, the one that they didn't want to be counted, into a wooden urn. Presumably, they kept their thumb and finger over the ends of the axles so that those standing next to them couldn't see how they were voting. Keep your thumb and finger over each end of the axle. Nobody knows whether that's the hollow or the solid one. The ballots in the bronze urn were then emptied out onto a board and they were counted. And the defendant was either acquitted or accused, found guilty that is, depending on the number of solid or hollow axle ballots that had been cast. If the jurors declared the defendant innocent, they drew their pay and went home. If it was the end of the day, that is, they would then listen to another private suit if they did. So the defendant, he also went home. If they found the defendant guilty and there was the option of a speech to suggest an alternate penalty, the jurors returned to their seats. Now, the Athenian constitution says that they stood to cast their votes. So presumably they stayed standing while the ballots were counted. Otherwise, they would have had to have returned to the seats and then got up again if the defendant was acquitted. Once they were settled again, the jurors sat through the final third of the tripartite day to hear speeches about the penalty. Both the prosecutor and the defendant put forward alternate penalties. If a guilty party was going to be punished by exile, for example, he might try to commute his sentence somewhat by asking to return after a certain number of years, or perhaps asking that his property not be confiscated by the state, but that his family might retain control of it. The most famous alternative penalty is perhaps that of Socrates in 399. Socrates was put on trial in that year on trumped-up charges of impiety and corrupting the youth. We've mentioned this case before. The charges, although they were concocted, were serious ones, and he was found guilty and sentenced to death. The jurors at his trial knew that it was a political one, and so too did Socrates. In a previous lecture, we talked about Plato's Crito, where Crito visits Socrates in prison on the eve of the execution and urges Socrates to escape. He would be safe living elsewhere, says Crito, and the Athenians would have breathed a sigh of relief to get him out of Athens, because that's all they wanted to do, to get rid of him. But Socrates refused. He drank the hemlock the next day and died. Now, since everyone at the trial knew Socrates was a victim, really a victim of political charges, the jurors would probably have been prepared to adopt a lesser penalty, such as Socrates proposing that he move into a self-imposed exile, that he quit Attica. Instead, a scornful and defiant Socrates stood up before the jury and proposed that instead of being executed, he should be fed at state expense for the rest of his life. This was, of course, rejected, and he drank the hemlock. Were the law formally prescribed a penalty, the defendant could not, of course, propose an alternative one. Premeditated homicide, for example, carried the death penalty, and there was no wriggling out of that. Those sentenced to death faced execution by one of three ways. There was the pit or chasm, into which the condemned man was thrown, either to die from the fall or starvation from being left there. The second one was the board, on which the guilty person was shackled by iron rings around his neck, wrists, and ankles. And he was either left out to die from exposure or the iron collar around his neck gradually strangled him. Finally, there was the drinking of hemlock, as Socrates chose. Exile was another penalty for major crimes, and those who were punished with death or exile also had their property confiscated by the state. Sometimes even their families and descendants were disfranchised. So that's what I mean when I say that someone sentenced to exile might plead that his property not be confiscated, might plead that his family might continue to live in the house or retain ownership of it. The Athenian constitution tells us that trials were over and done with in a day. In fact, it says that four private ones were heard by one court and one public case was heard by another one. This makes the procedure very rushed, especially given time limits that included the quoting of evidence. Now, this is very different from today, of course, when we have trials that stretch for months in a major public case, years even. Also, normally when the defendant was guilty, the punishment was carried out the next day, and this included execution. So there's no such thing in classical Athens as a long-term death row. There was no filing of multiple stays of execution or appeals to have death sentences commuted on grounds that the method of execution was cruel or unconstitutional. However, I personally query, which is a sort of polite way of saying get ready for another heresy, I personally query whether high-profile public cases could be dealt with in a day. I think that in some cases the trial could extend overnight and into the next day. Now, as I say, this is one of my heresies, but let's think about cases where we have multiple prosecutors and very long speeches. For example, in 323 BC, Demosthenes the orator was put on trial for treason. This was a trumped-up charge, as had been the one against Socrates, but Demosthenes was a major public figure. Now, if he'd been put on trial today, court TV would have had a field day with it. Demosthenes was prosecuted by 10 men, and they were appointed by the state, so they were 10 synagoroi, public prosecutors. And we have one fairly extant prosecution speech from his trial, and one speech that is horribly fragmented. We might have only a third of it. The first one, that's the one that's reasonably extant, reasonably complete, takes up about 30 pages or so of Greek text, and it couldn't have been given in just a few minutes. Now, not all of the 10 prosecutors, these 10 synagoroi, might have spoken for the same length of time. Some might have just stood up and said, "Find him guilty, gentlemen of the jury," and then sat down again. But when we think about 10 prosecution speeches, plus all manner of supporting evidence, it's hard to think about all of that fitting into the 2-hour, 12-minute limit. Demosthenes himself would have spoken at length in his defense. Demosthenes was known for his verbosity. Here he's on trial for treason, so he's not going to be terse. We don't have his speech from his trial, but the prosecution speeches that we do have, those two that I just mentioned, refer to Demosthenes using character witnesses, and these would have taken time. And then there's the matter of how long it would have taken the jury to vote and for the ballots to be counted, because the jury at Demosthenes' trial numbered 1,501. Furthermore, in the classical period, a new word comes into existence, dikatsein. It has the specialized meaning of large-scale bribery of jurors. The Greek word deka just means 10, but dikatsein in a legal sense is more than 10. It means large-scale bribery of jurors. Now, you don't have a word for something unless that something is happening. It would be impossible to bribe the jurors at a regular trial because no one could predict who would be selected that day. The selection process was arbitrary, so there was little point trying to bribe anyone unless you bribed all of the men turning up at daybreak wanting to be selected for jury duty. But if a trial went into a second day and that same jury reconvened on day two, which it would have done, then you have that night to nobble the jurors. And there's also the ominous line in the Athenian constitution that after the introduction of jury pay in the 450s, corruption began. So clearly, corruption began. The Athenian constitution tells us that. How on earth can you corrupt the jurors when you have this arbitrary, this haphazard selection process? There's something else going on behind the scenes. So the length of a political trial actually is very interesting in many respects, and it shows us, I think, that there's nothing clear-cut when we come to deal with ancient history or ancient society. Even the length of the trial, you can write articles about it. And so we move now to the speeches of prosecution and defense, which were also very different from those of today. Now, we have a goodly number of actual forensic speeches that have survived. We don't have hundreds or millions or anything like that, and there must have been hundreds, must have been thousands that were delivered in the courts over the century and a half or so from Ephialtes down to the abolition of democracy by the Macedonians in 322. Today, we only have a fraction of that. But there's a very good collection of them, translated, of course, in that book by Chris Carey called Trials from Classical Athens, which is in your bibliography. And he also has a very good introduction in that book summarizing the legal system. And it's always it's a good book to dip into, and I'd recommend it. As I said, he has about 24 or so translated speeches from a variety of suits: adultery, assault and battery, inheritance, slander, business and commerce. The collection, by the way, also includes that speech against Neaera by Apollodorus. Neaera, remember, was prosecuted for allegedly passing off her bastard children as legitimate, and we've mentioned that speech from time to time. It's interesting, by the way, that with the exception of two highly political showpiece trials, all of our extant speeches are either the prosecution one or the defense one in a particular case. We don't have both sides. We don't have prosecution and defense, except in two high-profile trials. Perhaps the reason why we only have prosecution or defense in so many private trials or minor public ones, well, major public ones too, is perhaps that the ones we have today were the successful ones. So there was no need to record and circulate for posterity the speeches that failed. Now, if this is true, that means that Neaera, for example, was found guilty of trying to pass off children as legitimate Athenian citizens, because we don't have her husband's defense speech from the trial, we only have that prosecution one. As for these highly political or showpiece trials that I just mentioned, both of them have Demosthenes facing off against his political opponent Aeschines. The first time was in 343 BC, the second time in 330. And I intend to talk about these trials when we deal with that historical period in our later lectures. Much of the content of the speeches that we have today would have been ruled inadmissible and probably have the speaker fined for contempt and even disbarment today. Slander of opponents was prevalent, and indeed it was enjoyed. Thus, you could call someone a wife-beater or a murderer of his parents or a sycophant with no grounds to support your allegation. And for the most part, you could get away with it. Personal invective, patriotic appeals to Athens's glorious past, especially to the defeat of the Persians, gossip, innuendo, and so on, were part and parcel of a forensic speech, and they were relished by the jurors. Perhaps the worst rhetorical technique is the argument of probability, and this was used ad nauseam. We mentioned this within the context of our discussion on the rise of rhetoric, but we can say a few more things about it here. For example, if someone were on trial for, let's say, stealing a sheep, and he'd done this sort of thing before, then probably, heavily underlined, he was guilty this time, and so should be found guilty again. So the prosecutor might run a line such as, "Gentlemen of the jury, we all know this man has been convicted of stealing a sheep before. We all know one of my own sheep is missing right now. So there's no question he probably took it and you should find him guilty. It's no wonder that Plato, for example, condemned the argument based on probability. And he pleaded that people should take into account only the facts and only the laws, and not be swayed by rhetoric. He was disregarded, of course. Because just as rhetoric often ruled the assembly, a great oral performance could mask a weak case in court. And so rhetoric ruled the domain of the law courts as well. A skillful speaker could also use laws that had no bearing on the case to denigrate an opponent. In 345 BC, for example, the orator Aeschines prosecuted a man called Timarchus, and he did so under a procedure called the docimasia ton rhetoron, which means scrutiny of public speakers, so anyone who speaks in the assembly. Timarchus was a speaker in the assembly, he was a politician. He was also an opponent of Aeschines. Now, the speaker's personal lives were an item of concern for the Athenians. And so Aeschines took advantage of the fact that Timarchus was a male prostitute. And he prosecuted Timarchus on these grounds of male prostitution. Now, this sort of job, being a male prostitute, was especially scorned by the Athenians, because the man was assuming the woman's role in sex. Here we're talking about anal intercourse. So this was not merely unnatural, it was unmanly. Aeschines' charge is a political one then, against an opponent. But to lend weight to his case, Aeschines invokes laws that have nothing to do with the actual charge. He invokes laws like protecting children from prostitution, regulating conduct in schools and gymnasia, and so on. Now, this is the sort of thing that would be thrown out of court today, I would imagine, for lack of relevance, or for being unduly prejudicial. But the jurors at Timarchus's trial lapped it up because they found him guilty. It was also common for defendants to parade their wives and children through court, crying and gnashing their teeth, in an attempt to gain the sympathy of the jurors. Socrates, at his trial in 399, says that he's going to be different from other litigants because he will not resort to this practice. But Socrates was in a minority, and this parade of children and wives gave rise to people hiring out their children. So it looked as if the defendant had a whole tribe of kids, and the jury should feel that it needs to acquit him. Otherwise, who would look after the unfortunate wife and all those children? Another difference also between then and now, given the large size of juries in Athens, and these could often run into several hundreds, was the noise level and the ability to hear properly. We've mentioned this already in the context of an assembly meeting attended by several thousand citizens, but the courts were no different in terms of being able to hear what went on. Today, a jury sits quietly. If there's any noise in the courtroom, the judge bangs his gavel to restore order, and everyone can hear properly. But not back then. For one thing, as in the assembly, there was no public address system to allow a large audience to hear a speaker clearly. Those jurors who were sitting further away from the speakers simply couldn't hear as clearly as those who were sitting closer. Moreover, some might be chatting among themselves, perhaps asking the person sitting next to him what a speaker had just said. Some got distracted in other ways, such as eating their sandwiches for lunch or watching birds fly overhead. Remember, the courts were open-roofed. But how on earth would you be able to hear, say, one of the prosecution speeches against Demosthenes, or indeed Demosthenes' defense speech in 323, when you were sitting among 1,501 jurors, and you might be sitting some distance from those who were speaking? you simply couldn't hear what was going on. Speakers didn't stop if jurors got distracted. I believe today the jury can actually, that a member of a modern jury can ask a question during a court, can ask during a case, can ask for a point of order or clarification. But back then, if the jury wanted to talk amongst itself, it simply lost track of what the speakers were saying. They didn't stop. So that meant that by the time you'd ask the person sitting next to you, hey, what did he say just then? I missed it. And you got your reply, the speaker was already well on into his other subject. And that meant now that both of you had lost track of what was going on. Prosecution and defense had to be very careful, though, to make sure that the jurors didn't become too confused or indeed too annoyed from speeches, the content of which they couldn't hear. Because then the jury might react adversely against the speaker. That's the very last thing somebody wants to happen. That's perhaps why speakers encourage the jurors to shout or to applaud or to jeer at certain times. Now, this was a rhetorical technique known as theroubos, a Greek word that means uproar. So the court seemed to be something like an English pantomime, with the audience being encouraged to cheer when the hero walks on stage or boo when the villain appears. And everyone likes doing this, even if we've lost our place in the plot for a few moments. It's hardly a surprise then that our anti-hero in Aristophanes' Wasps says he enjoys being a juror for the entertainment value. Perhaps somewhat similar to today, though handled differently, is the sense of dramatic immediacy in the speeches that we have. Because speakers will often address the jurors directly, and they will challenge them to find a defendant guilty. Or if it's a defendant speaking, he will challenge the jurors to find him innocent. These speakers make it seem like the jury is on trial. They might run a line such as, for example, if you acquit him, gentlemen of Athens, what will you say to your wife and your family when you go home today? Or they might say, although you're judging this man, gentlemen of the jury, the whole of the city, indeed the whole of Greece, is judging you. Now today, attorneys in court look at jurors when they make their opening and closing statements, or when questioning those on the stand. And remember, in classical Athens, there's no cross-examination. And attorneys today might try to work on the jury's emotions before the judge intervenes. At least, that's what happens on episodes of Law and Order. However, this is very different from how speakers would whip up a jury in classical Athens. They really did encourage them to yell, to shout, to applaud, to take part in the case. To us, the Athenian court system might still seem very amateurish and like going to the theatre, to a pantomime. Yet, having said that, jurors took their dicastic oath seriously, and we discussed this at some length in a previous lecture. And the people as a whole recognized the importance of law in city life and how the safety of the city rested on the laws. Remember that phrase, rule of the law. So the classical judicial system shouldn't really be called inferior to ours. As I said before, we should just talk about it merely being different. And we should recognize that without it, we wouldn't enjoy the rights and privileges and the recourse to law and appeal that we have and that we take for granted today. Now, I mentioned before that the 4th century was one of great change for the Greek world. And in our next lectures, we return to what brought about that change, Macedonia. First under Philip II, who was king from 359 to 336, and then under his son, Alexander the Great, who was king from 336 to 323 BC. Indeed, we've got no choice but to turn to Macedonia now. Because while we've been discussing the sorts of legal changes and cases that were taking place in the later 4th century, Macedonia has already started to encroach on Greek autonomy. Thank you very much.